You shall not murder.
You shall not murder.
You shall not murder.
You shall not murder.
What does that mean?
Do not, like, take somebody's life away or, like, kill them or, like, do anything bad to them.
You shouldn't murder anyone. That's pretty much all that means.
That means don't kill anybody because it's murder and you shouldn't do it. And plus, you can go to jail for doing it.
It's dangerous and we'll get blood on our own hands.
You shall not kill another. Like, technically, when you think about it, that's like killing a family member of Christ.
Thou shalt not
murder.
Good morning! Welcome to Northridge. Welcome to the family. I'm afraid we're going to disappoint some of you this morning because some of you have been reading ahead and strategizing, the parents in the room, because the fifth commandment, we're in week 5 of our 10 commandment series written in stone, the fifth commandment is honor your father and mother. So kids, if you're in the room today and you're not usually in big church, now you know why. Your parents are coming for you. But like you heard the kids say, we're skipping over the fifth commandment this morning. Instead, we're talking about murder. Yes, we're skipping the fifth commandment because in a few weeks, all of our elementary kids are going to be joining us here. We all get to be kids for a week with our elementary teachers, and it's going to be a fantastic time to learn how to honor our fathers and mothers together. But right to the text this morning, Exodus 20, verse 13 says, "You shall not murder." That's all it says. You shall not murder. Don't murder. All right, everybody got it? We're good. Okay. Yeah, that's how we feel about this command, right? Most of us never killed anyone. Don't plan on it. Let's check this one off and move on. But I know that tension is building for some of you because you've read parts of the Bible, and there's a lot of killing in there. Right? God orders killing sometimes. He actually kills people himself sometimes. So we gotta like figure this thing out. What is going on here? What is murder? And first, I have to clarify that in both Hebrew and English, there's two different words, one word for killing and one word for murder. Two different words. And unfortunately, the old King James here says, "Thou shalt not kill." But it's a really unfortunate translation. The word there is not kill, it's definitely murder. And killing is not murder, at least not all the time. God kills people. Does that make me uncomfortable? Yes. Does that make God a murderer? No. Divine justice is not murder. The death penalty. We can talk about whether it's good for society or not, but the death penalty is not murder. Killing in self-defense. Killing enemy combatants in war, not murder. Should killing be avoided? Yes. Is all killing murder? No. So what's murder? Murder is the intentional and unjustified destruction of a human person. Some of us have actually killed another human. And we're going to have to address some really hard topics in a few minutes. But whether you have physically murdered or not, Jesus wants to speak to your heart this morning. One of the themes of our series is that God's commands reveal his heart. And we want to understand the heart of God underneath the command, do not murder. And to do that, we're going to the book of Matthew. That's where we find Jesus' longest recorded sermon called the Sermon on the Mount. You can turn to Matthew chapter 5 with me, or use the Northridge app to take notes, or follow along on the screen. So just like Moses goes up on the mountain to receive the law, Jesus goes up on the mountain to teach the law. And in this sermon, he explicitly addresses two of our Ten Commandments, do not murder and do not commit adultery, which Drew will be preaching next week. So good luck, Drew. Like all the pagan religions around them, the religious leaders of Jesus' day made their religion all about the things you do, It was about your actions, right? You don't speak the word Yahweh. You count your steps on the Sabbath to make sure you're not accidentally working. They were really good at keeping the letter of the law and ignoring the heart. And then Jesus comes along and he starts teaching with authority. Not just about how to follow the commands, but how to embody them. So Matthew 5, starting in 21, he says, "You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.' But I tell you that anyone who's angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment." It's tempting to view this as Jesus kind of discarding the whole old law and replacing it with a new one, or he's making some comparison between the old way of Judaism and his new way. But he specifically says that's not what he's doing. In verse 17, "Do not think I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." So Jesus isn't nullifying the commandment here, and he's not just raising the bar, like, do not murder, the old commandment, that was sufficient for the ancients, but it's not good enough anymore. Like, we Jesus people, we hardcore, so we gotta make it harder. No, he's not just getting rid of the commandment, he's not raising the bar, he's helping us understand the fulfillment of the commandment. What is the wisdom underneath it and the heart behind it? So we're gonna walk through this one step at a time. "You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.'" So the command, "You shall not murder," and then they attached a consequence, like a legal consequence, to the command, subject to judgment. And that basically means you will be held accountable by the local court. Same thing that happens here in Rochester. You murder somebody, hopefully the local court will bring you to justice, right? Now, let's see what he goes to next. "I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment." Jesus assigns the same penalty to anger and murder. And the idea here is murderous rage. This is how Cain felt about his brother Abel before the first murder in history. Murderous rage. And in Jesus' kingdom, a murderous heart is just as bad as committing a murder. A murderous heart is just as guilty as a murderous action. So when do you experience rage? Where have you held on to anger? I found myself getting angry just a few days ago. I have a friend who doesn't have a laundry machine, and so once in a while I do some laundry for him. And he'd been calling a few times, and I'd been ignoring his calls because I didn't really want to do his laundry. But finally, I was convicted, and so I called him back. And of course, in the conversation, he brings up the laundry, and I realize I've got a few minutes before I've got to drive to my next appointment anyway, so I'll just swing by right now. I'll pick it up. I'll get it done tonight. So in the past, when I've gone to pick up laundry for him, he's had the basket ready for me right there in front of the door. So I thought this is going to be grab and go, no problem. But I walk in, and I notice there's no laundry basket there, and he's on the phone. And he's walking around his apartment, slowly like gathering pieces of clothing from various piles and throwing them somewhere in the back. And I realize immediately, I'm going to be late. Now, I'm not Drew, so I'm late sometimes. Pretty often I'm late, and it doesn't bother me as long as I'm the reason I'm late. Okay? Now, then he sits down in a chair right next to me, and he just casually continues his phone conversation. I have yet to see the laundry basket, and I can feel the frustration, like, physically growing inside my body. I am not thinking loving thoughts at the moment. Right? When we harbor anger in our hearts, we are not acting like God's family. So today, on your way home, when the old man's doing the speed limit in the fast lane, tonight when your toddler spills the box of toys you just cleaned up, tomorrow morning when your boss takes credit for all that work that you did, when your ex exists, are you angry? What is your anger doing in your heart? Right? Are you becoming more like the giver of life or like the one who comes to steal and kill and destroy? We'll come back to the laundry in a minute. But for now, let's see how Jesus continues. Matthew 5:22. But I tell you, anyone who's angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Let's look at these offenses for a moment. Jesus takes us from murder to murderous rage to Raca. Raca basically means empty-headed or good for nothing. So if you tell your sister, Raca, you're basically saying, you're worthless. That's a pretty significant insult. Maybe not quite as bad as murderous rage. Then we get, you fool, which is where we get the word moron. This is kind of a minor insult, like a little bit of mockery. Ah, he's such an idiot. What a moron. Look on the other side at the consequences. Jesus takes us from the local court, subject to judgment, to the court, that means the Supreme Court, to hellfire, okay? What is happening here? We get murder, guilty before the local court. Then Jesus tells us murderous rage, local court, deep insult, Supreme Court. A little bit of mockery, divine court. Jesus, what are you doing? What are you telling us? He develops this shocking puzzle to force us to ask the question, what do murder, rage, insults, and mockery have in common? And the answer to the riddle is contempt. In Jesus' kingdom, contempt is equivalent to murder. Contempt is the attitude that says, I am your evaluator. I've looked at your life, the things you've done, who you are, and I've decided you don't matter. You're worthless. And that's the attitude behind murder. Murder says you don't have any value. You're better off dead. I'm better off if you're dead. Your life isn't worth living. And when we call our friend good for nothing, we're putting ourselves in the place of God, because only God gets to determine the value of a human life. When you treat others with contempt, you put yourself in the place of God. And how valuable is a human being in God's sight? Look at what he says in Genesis. God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. This is the foundational doctrine that underlies human dignity. Every single person is created with the imprint of the divine and is therefore infinitely valuable. Think about it this way. I've got a picture of some art up here. How do we know how much art is worth? What's the value of that piece? We can't like add up time and materials and figure out the value of art, right? No. I don't know about you, I wouldn't really want that piece in my living room. Like, it looks kind of weird. But that thing sold a few years ago for $100 million. $100 million. Why? Because some guy named Pablo Picasso painted it, all right? Now, how about this piece? That is a banana duct taped to a wall. Now, if I duct tape a banana to the wall, it's worth nothing. But that piece just last year went on auction and sold for over $6 million for a banana duct tape to a wall. What is art worth? How do we know how much art is worth? Whatever someone will pay for it. That's what it's worth. Friends, whether it's a banana or a Picasso, art is worth whatever someone will pay for it. And not only is God himself the artist who created us, but Jesus paid his very life to purchase you and I. Can anything possibly be of more value than the life of God? So when you've got to one-up your friend's story because your fish was a little bigger, or your labor was a little longer, or your teacher was a little worse? When what you have to say is so important, you've got to interrupt and talk over other people? When your family has to compete with your phone for your attention? What are you saying? I'm better than you. My ideas are more important than yours. The strangers on my phone are more valuable than you are. My entertainment is more important than our relationship. What are we saying to our God when we treat others with contempt? Nah, God, they're not, you shouldn't have died for them. Let's dig even deeper. When Jesus says calling someone a moron put you in danger of hellfire, he doesn't actually use the word hell there. He's not talking about the afterlife. He's referring to a literal valley outside Jerusalem. He's naming a valley. What does this valley mean to Jesus? Centuries before, two kings from the line of David, these are Jesus' direct ancestors, they built furnaces in this valley to sacrifice children. Child sacrifice. This is totally abhorrent. And God says this is unthinkable. And God promises to destroy the kingdom because of this specific wickedness. So, the Babylonians conquered Judah and destroyed Jerusalem, and there were so many dead, they couldn't find a place to bury them. So they threw the bodies in that valley. This is clearly an act of divine justice. God turns the fires lit to consume the innocent back on the ones who lit them. And that is the shocking image that Jesus calls to mind for those who treat others with contempt. Jesus is saying, be careful, friends. Even small acts of disrespect, that sarcastic jab at a friend, that joke you made to get a laugh at the expense of your wife, those are like harboring contempt. It's like lighting a fire. Watch out. If left unchecked, the fire of contempt will consume your soul. Family, where have you directed your anger? Who have you belittled with your words or attitudes or actions? Who do you look down on? So there I am. I'd gotten up from writing this sermon about murder and anger and contempt. And I'm standing there in my friend's doorway, waiting and getting angry. And I notice, I start to overhear his phone call, and I notice who's on the other end of the line, sitting there talking. And it's none other than Jack, one of the senior saints of our church, one of the oldest living members of our Northridge family. And as he's talking, I realize he's speaking with so much dignity and respect and kindness. Jack, I don't know if you are listening to my voice this morning, but I want to say thank you for that conversation. So while I was treating my friend like a problem, you were treating him like a person. My friend's had a really hard life, and I tend to think that he needs me more than I need him. Last week, I needed him a lot more. He needed some laundry done. I needed a change of heart. And God used him to convict me of my sinful attitude of contempt, the ways I was subtly treating him as less valuable, as less human, as unworthy. Who is it for you? Is it the panhandling addict? Is it the sibling who grew up in the same house but made very different choices? Is it the coworkers who've just become faceless rungs on your corporate ladder? Who is beneath your notice? Here's today's big question. What step can you take today toward loving someone you've treated with contempt? Make a plan today to demonstrate love to someone that you've belittled. The Holy Spirit is already speaking into your mind, and some of you are trying to dismiss it. That's too scary. I couldn't. Friends, God Himself, the creator of the universe, formed you with His own hands. You are a picture of the divine. and so are they. See, we're all guilty before the divine court of treating others with contempt. We thought do not murder was the easy command, right? But there's another aspect to this command we have to talk about. Murder hits some cultural buttons that we'd probably rather skip past. But we're not here to shy away from difficult topics, because Jesus offers a better way. And the next few minutes might be really hard for some of you. Hang in there with me. The hope is coming. God says, Exodus 20:13, "You shall not murder." I think we can all agree, I hope, that don't murder is a good rule. Like, I want to live in a place where murder is not okay. Because otherwise it's like, man, that Soane's guy, isn't he annoying? Yeah, get rid of him, no problem. Yeah, I'm the first one gone if murder's okay, all right? We want to live in a place where murder is illegal. But here in New York, we've gotten our definitions a bit mixed up. Our legislature just passed the Medical Aid in Dying Act. It's sitting on the governor's desk. And it says that if someone is probably going to die soon and they want to die right now, no problem. Doctor can give them deadly drugs, they can take those deadly drugs, and the law says we're explicitly not allowed to use the word murder or suicide in that situation. At the beginning of life, we've decided that abortion is healthcare, it's not murder. And we used to argue that it's not murder because the fetus isn't a person. But the science is kind of caught up with that argument. It's getting harder and harder to say that that human being with its own unique human DNA is something other than a human person. But we still say, that's okay. Abortion is healthcare. It's not murder because killing that human is justifiable. It's a justified killing. There's something about the situation of the mother and her autonomous decision-making that means it's okay to kill that human. The problem is, we don't get to decide which life is valuable and which isn't. Only God gets to decide. I know I'm touching a really deeply personal topic. And some of you know what it's like to feel totally arrested, trapped, stuck by an unplanned pregnancy. Like you're in an impossible situation and there's no way out. Some of you know what it feels like to feel like no matter what you choose, you're choosing death. Either my life is over or my baby. Some of you know what it's like to feel torn between the public shame and embarrassment of a pregnancy or a baby and the private guilt of an abortion. And wouldn't it be easier if it just all went away? It's just a few pills and then my life will be back to normal. Only it's not quite back to normal, is it? And even now, in my words, you can feel the lump in your throat or the fire in your belly or the shame on your face. And if you don't know what that feels like, you know someone who does. In the United States, 1 in 4 women will have had an abortion by the time they age out of their reproductive years. Here in New York State, more than 25% of all pregnancies end in abortion. Whether abortion has directly touched your life or not, I want you to leave today with a sense of hope. There is grace and forgiveness for you. The truth is that all of us often fail to bear his name well. Maybe you've had a child aborted. There is grace for you. Maybe you've physically murdered someone. There's grace. There's forgiveness for you. Maybe you have had a murderous heart. Maybe you've belittled others with your words and attitudes and actions. I want you to hear this, brothers and sisters. Hear this. You are so precious to God. You are so precious to God that he made a way to free you from guilt and shame. You're so precious to God that he sent his own son to fulfill the law, to go to the cross, to die in your place, to rise again, to conquer sin and death forever. you're so precious to God that he welcomes you into his own family. You are the sons and daughters of the one true King. You're so precious to God that he's not content to let you light fires of contempt in your soul. He knows those fires will only consume you from the inside, deform you, change your thoughts and words into insults and rage that only lead to self-destruction. You're so precious to God that he won't coerce you. He won't force you to walk his way, but he will invite you. His arms are open. He is gracious and forgiving. He loves. He says, I love you. Join me in my love. Love as I love. He loves you. He really loves you. Let's reject the arrogance of contempt and fill our souls with the love of our Savior. God, please help us. We need you. We're desperate for your forgiveness and grace. Help us to walk in love today and receive your immeasurable love for us. Amen.